Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, well, today we're going to answer some of the emails that I get. I get so many, they're just piling up on my desk, and it's about time that I answer some of them. And also, let me say that I'm touring the country. Go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org, and maybe, just maybe, I'll be signing a copy of my latest bestseller, and after I sign it, you can go to eBay and auction it off for money. Yes, that's right. You can actually make money going to the various places where I'll be speaking concerning a book tour. So the website is mkaku.org, mkaku.org. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers. The latest one is The Future of Humanity. Humanity in Outer Space. Will one day we go back to the moon, Mars, and even beyond that? Will we fulfill the dream of becoming a spacefaring civilization? Also, The Future of the Mind. Talking about telepathy, telekinesis, even recording dreams. Things that we physicists can now do, because we can now probe right into the living brain and connect the brain to a computer. And then Physics of the Future. I talk about robots, artificial intelligence, the job market, medicine in that book. And then Physics of the Impossible. I go way out there in outer space. I talk about the possibility of time travel, possibility of starships, possibility of ray guns, all that stuff that you see on Star Trek and Star Wars, I talk about in my other book, Physics of the Impossible. So find out more by going to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org, and find out if I'll be speaking near a city next to you. Well, today, I'm going to answer some of the emails that I get, and I get a lot of emails concerning, well, you guessed it, UFOs, aliens from outer space. We're going to talk about that. And also jobs. What are the jobs of the future going to look like? And medicine. Why is cancer so difficult to cure? And what's in the future for medicine? And then we're going to talk about, well, the far future. So once again, in this hour of Exploration, we're going to talk about, well, some of the questions that you ask me on email. Well, one series of questions I get concerns aliens from outer space. Do I believe that UFOs are from another planet? What about all the planets we've been discovering orbiting other stars in outer space? And what will they look like? If one day we encounter an alien species, what are they going to look like? How will they communicate? What kind of technology will they have? Well, we'll say a few things about that. And we'll say a few things about the job market, say a few things about even immortality. Well, let's get right to it. We have, first of all, we have the fact that many people, thousands of them, have claimed to have seen a flying saucer. Maybe you've seen a flying saucer, in fact. Well, I get a lot of emails from people that have seen flying saucers. And about 90% of the time, I can pretty rapidly dismiss it as a meteor, as some kind of atmospheric anomaly, as maybe a weather balloon, maybe a launch of a rocket or an airplane that went awry, any number of things. However, there's that last 5 to 10% of these sightings that make the hair on the back of your head stand up. Because they're multiple sightings by multiple modes, not just one person saying, hey, Martha, look, the flying saucer up there. No, seasoned pilots, military people tracking these things by radar, seeing them zigzag on the radar screen. How do we explain that? These sightings show that these objects can maneuver in ways that we cannot. Second, that they can travel at tremendous speeds, outracing our jets, and they just disappear. What could be responsible? Well, there are at least two explanations. One explanation is that, well, maybe they really are extraterrestrial craft. You can't rule it out. That's one viable possibility. Another possibility is that they are hypersonic glide vehicles. Now, let me explain. The Russians last year announced the fact that they're perfecting a new generation of weapons to evade a Star Wars defensive shield. In order to do that, you have to have a rocket that A, goes very fast, B, is maneuverable, and bingo, that's the hypersonic drive vehicle. We're talking about an airplane-like object that can travel 5 to 20 times the speed of sound, faster than any of our known jets, and maneuver so they can evade a Star Wars defensive shield. Well, the Russians say that they actually have one, and it's perfected, and it works. The United States tried 2 years ago and gave up because they're very unstable. These things zigzag in outer space. It's very easy for them to simply get out of control. The Chinese have said that, yes, they too are working on hypersonic drive vehicles. So I'm not saying that all these UFO sightings are military secret craft. All I'm saying that it is consistent. That A, they can outrace any known jet, and B, they can zigzag even though they travel at Mach 5 to Mach 20. So that's a possibility. But then the next question is, well, let's say the first hypothesis is correct, that they really are alien spacecraft. Then, well, where do they come from? Well, so far, the Kepler satellite and astronomers on Earth have identified 4,000 planets circling other stars, and a handful of them look very similar to the planet Earth. Now, the holy grail of all this is to find an exact twin of the Earth. We haven't done that yet. We want to find a planet with the same size, with temperatures that are mild so that we have liquid water oceans, and perhaps an oxygen atmosphere, an Earth-like doppelganger in outer space. We haven't seen one yet, but now we have a new satellite up in outer space called TESS. Even though Kepler only looked at a small portion of the night sky and zeroed in on it and found 4,000 exoplanets in that small sector of the sky, TESS scans the entire sky and looks for Earth-like planets. So maybe one day TESS will announce that they found an Earth-like twin, a planet with the same size, with liquid water oceans and an oxygen atmosphere. Then the next question is, well, where could they be? First of all, our galaxy contains 100 billion stars. How many galaxies are there? Well, we don't know, but the Hubble Space Telescope can see 100 billion. So how many stars are there? 100 billion times 100 billion. And how many of them have planets going around it? On average, every star you see at night, on average, has a planet going around it. Most of the time, Jupiter-sized, but about 1 in 20 of them have Earth-sized planets going around it. So how many potential habitats do we have in outer space that are Earth-like? Well, think about it. 100 billion times 100 billion divided by 20. That is a huge number. And then the next question is, well, why don't they visit the planet Earth? I mean, this is the Fermi paradox. If they're out there, they have advanced technology. How come they don't land on the White House lawn and advertise their existence? Well, there are several possibilities explored in science fiction movies. I like to think that if you're walking in a forest and you see a squirrel or a deer, you may want to try to talk to the squirrel or deer. But after a while, you get bored because they don't talk back to you and they have nothing interesting to say to you. So you leave them alone. Or you go to the zoo, plenty of animals in the zoo to talk to. So one possibility is that, yeah, they're out there, but we're simply too primitive because we have nothing to offer them. Why should they communicate with us? Because, well, it's like talking to the deer. They don't talk back to you. They have nothing to offer. So that's a possibility. Or perhaps we're in a zoo and the prime directive says it should not interfere with our natural development. Yeah, that's another possibility. So there are many possibilities and there's no way to test them. However, my late colleague, Stephen Hawking, said that, watch out, it's not a good idea to make contact with them because maybe, just maybe, they may be malicious. Who knows? Maybe they want to conquer us. After all, look at what happened to Montezuma and the Aztecs when they encountered Cortez. Well, they made a big mistake. They thought that Cortez and his band of conquistador cutthroats, they thought they were gods. No, they were not gods. They were not after salvation or anything. They were after gold and plunder. So, my colleague Stephen Hawking says, watch out. It may not be a good idea to make contact with them until we know what they want. And then the other question is that every science fiction movie has to grapple with is that what are they going to look like? Well, when you see science fiction movies, they look just like us, except a little bit of eye makeup, little makeup around the nose and the skull. Otherwise, they look just like us. But look around the planet Earth. There are animals that are bizarre on the planet Earth that may one day also become intelligent, like a lobster, for example. Now, what are they going to look like? Well, we don't know, of course, but there are three things that made us become intelligent. Chances are they will have these three. First is some kind of eye, stereo eye, the eye of a hunter. Hunters are smarter than prey. We say, sly as a fox and dumb bunny. And what about the eyes of a fox and the eyes of a rabbit? The eyes of a fox, shark, tiger, lion face to the front. Stereo eyes. Eyes of a hunter. Eyes to lock on to the prey. But if you're prey, all you have to do is run. That's why you have eyes to the side of your face to see 360 degrees. And who is smarter? The fox is smarter because the fox has to know how to ambush, how to hide, how to camouflage, how to stalk, how to understand the habits of your prey. That takes a lot of brain power. So chances are aliens in outer space will be descended from predators. That doesn't mean they're going to be vicious. It just means that, well, they will have predator ancestors. Second, we have an opposable thumb. Our opposable thumb was there so that we can swing in trees. Well, we don't swing in trees in Africa anymore, but we use that thumb for grasping. However, you could also have a tentacle, a claw, some way to manipulate the environment. So hand-eye coordination is the key, eyes and hand. And then, once you get knowledge about the world, you want to pass it down to the next generation. That means language. So these are the three ingredients that made us become intelligent. Eyes, preferably the eyes of a predator, eyes to the front of your face, hand or claw or a tentacle, and a language to hand down information. Now, let me ask you a question. In the entire animal kingdom, how many animals have all three? How many animals have great stereo eyesight, the eyesight of a hunter, hand to have hand-eye coordination, and a language to hand it down to the next generation? Well, you can see that humans are at the top in terms of all three. Some animals have claws, some animals have eyes, some animals have a little bit of language, but who has perfected all three? And that is humans. So chances are when we meet aliens from outer space, they'll have at least those three characteristics. However, what are they going to look like when we actually meet them? We may be surprised to find that they could be part cybernetic and part genetically modified, because that's the direction that we are going as well. So you have to realize that they may not look like their original ancestors. In fact, some people say that sending Captain Kirk to go between planets in the galaxy is the most stupid, ridiculous way to explore the galaxy. There are just too many planets out there. A better way is to send self-replicating robots. These are called von Neumann probes. They land on a moon because it's stable, barren, no rust, no erosion, no water, no oxygen. And all they do is observe and make copies of themselves. They dig into the lunar soil and they make a factory to make copies of themselves. And they shoot out, land on other moons to make copies of them So starting with one von Neumann probe, you get 100, then 1,000, then 1,000,000, then 1,000,000,000. And pretty soon, you can colonize the entire galaxy in about 200,000 years. So these are called von Neumann probes, and that's the basis of a movie. It's also the basis of a form of life on the Earth. What movie has this idea that on the moon there's a probe just waiting for us to become mature enough to make contact? A probe that is self-replicating makes copies of itself to explore the other solar systems. Well, that movie is 2001. In fact, of all the science fiction movies that I've seen, I have to admit that 2001 is perhaps the most realistic in terms of depiction of life in the universe, perhaps on our moon, perhaps on our own moon. There is a von Neumann probe that is scanning us, just waiting for us to make contact with them. So I think that's why the movie 2001 is perhaps the most realistic of all science fiction movies. And speaking about robots, the question is, are the robots going to take over? Well, I don't think so, but you can't rule it out. And so then the next question is, well, who is right, Zuckerberg or Elon Musk? Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook, says that artificial intelligence will be great, create jobs, industries, whole new economic horizons. And then we have Elon Musk, who says, wait a minute, they pose an existential threat. We could be making our next evolutionary successor. Evolution shows us that one animal replaces as predators, and that's the law of nature, the law of evolution. Watch out, says Elon Musk. Who's right? Well, I think in the short term, Zuckerberg is right. Artificially intelligent beings are pretty stupid. Our most advanced robots can just barely walk across the room. We've been brainwashed by Hollywood into thinking that these killing machines are just around the corner. Nope. Our most advanced robot can't even pick up garbage. That's how primitive they are. But eventually, who knows? I mean, after all, how smart is a robot? A robot today, the smartest robots today, have the intelligence of a cockroach. A lobotomized, retarded, stupid cockroach. They can barely walk across the room. However, real cockroaches can run, hide, find mates, find food, scurry around the forest, evade obstacles, leaving our poor robot in the dust. However, let's be honest, it's only a matter of time before our insect-like robots become smarter, smart as a mouse. As the decades go by, smart as a rat, smart as a rabbit, smart as a cat or a dog. And eventually, by the end of the century, who knows for sure, perhaps as smart as a monkey. Now that's dangerous, because monkeys are self-aware. Monkeys know they are not human. They know they're monkeys. Now, dogs are confused. Dogs think that we are a dog. That's why they slobber all over us, because we're the top dog. They're the underdog. They think that we're a dog of some sort. Monkeys have no illusions whatsoever. And that means that by the end of the century, who knows when, we have to be careful. Robots may become self-aware. At that point, watch out. But in the meantime, there are going to be a lot of jobs, a lot of industries opening up because of artificial intelligence. And then the question is, what jobs are going to be available? Well, what can robots do? Robots can basically do two things. First, they can add. They are glorified adding machines. They add a million times faster than us, giving us the illusion they're thinking. They're not thinking at all. Second, data crunching. They can crunch vast amounts of data in a flash. So what jobs are going to disappear? Jobs that are repetitive, jobs that involve searching through large amounts of data crunching. Those jobs are going to go out the window. Sorry about that. But there are three types of jobs which cannot be done by robots in the foreseeable future. That's where the jobs of the future are. And you should listen, because maybe you know somebody who's looking for a job, or somebody who's retraining for a job and hopes that job won't be obsolete by the time he gets a degree. Three types of jobs that are open. One is semi-skilled job involving manual dexterity, pattern recognition. For example, picking up garbage, fixing a broken toilet, wiring up a house, plumbing, carpentry, electrician's work. Robots can't do any of those things. Believe it or not, robots are so stupid they can't even pick up garbage off the floor. Every piece of garbage is different. That's the key. Every crime is different. Every one of these tasks is different, requiring a set of skills that are not repetitive. Those jobs will survive. Second, jobs that involve human interactions. That is, a lawyer, because a lawyer has to convince a judge. A lawyer has to convince a jury. Lawyers will have jobs because they have to interact with people, and people have changing ethical standards. Robots don't understand any of that. Will professors have a job? Well, the day-to-day teaching will be done by robots in the future. E-courses will replace most of the lectures of today. But who's going to grade your homework assignment? Who's going to give you career guidance? Who's going to mentor you? Who's going to help you find your true calling in life? That's where professors become mentors rather than regurgitating ordinary language. So people involved in human resources, counselors, robots can't do any of that stuff because every human is individual. Every human has a very complex set of psychological drives. And, well, robots can be mechanical and give you basically a checklist of different kinds of things to look out for. But to tailor make it for the individual person, that's really hard. So those jobs are going to survive. Jobs that involve human interaction. And the third set of jobs is intellectual capital. Jobs that involve human skills. Skills of the mind, like telling a joke, writing a novel, doing a science project, discovering new laws of science, writing code, things that involve the mind. Or as Tony Blair liked to say, England derives more revenue from rock and roll than it does the coal industry. Because rock and roll is intellectual capital and coal is commodity capital, which is getting cheaper every year. And then I get another set of questions about, well, immortality. Can one day we live forever? Well, there are two kinds of immortality. There's genetic immortality and digital immortality. Digital immortality we will get. One day we will digitize everything known about you. And when you go to the library, instead of taking out a book about Winston Churchill, you'll talk to Winston Churchill. You'll talk to a hologram or an avatar, looks exactly like him, scans all his memories, can tell jokes just like he did, write speeches just like he did, a carbon copy of Winston Churchill. I mean, I wouldn't mind talking to Einstein. I would love the idea to talk to the man, find out his thinking, talk to a computer program that has accessed all his notes, his books, his speeches, his appearances, his diaries, whatever. And one day, you might be digitized as well, so that your great-great-great-great-great-grandkids can have a conversation with you or something that looks just like you. That's coming fairly soon. And then we have genetic immortality, which is further down the line. For example, take a look at a car. Where does aging take place in a car? Well, the engine. That's where you have moving parts. That's where you have combustion. So what is the engine of a cell? The mitochondria. Bingo. That's where aging takes place. Because aging is the accumulation of error, genetic error, cellular error, molecular error, mistakes. That's what aging is, the accumulation of mistakes inside a cell. So cells become sluggish and eventually die. In fact, that's why we die. But now we have something called CRISPR technology, editing technology. In the future, we're going to be able to edit. Instead of just typing words, they'll type genes. They'll type ATCG, ATCG, and create a virus right there on the spot with a typewriter, a genetic typewriter, that translates ATCG into nucleic acids. But anyway, the point is that with CRISPR technology, we may be able to tailor-make genes, repair damage, use gene therapy to repair damage so that the mitochondria of the cell no longer accumulates so many mutations. Now, take a look at the animal kingdom. Different animals age at different rates. Mice, for example, some mice only live about 2 years. But the Greenland shark lives for over 450 years. Practically a world's record. Think about that. A vertebrate, a fish that can live for over 450 years. And we know that by analyzing the eyeball and counting the layers of tissue in the eyeball of the Greenland shark. How does it do it? We don't know. One theory is that it's very cold in the Arctic. That slows down metabolism and oxidation. Oxidation takes place in the mitochondria. And so by slowing down the oxidation process, you can live forever. In fact, caloric restriction is the only known way of extending the lifespan of an animal. If you feed an animal 30% less calories, it lives 30% longer. Amazing. And it works. Every time we've tried it, it works. So what's the catch? There's always a catch someplace, right? The catch is that these animals become lethargic, slow-moving. They lose joie de vivre. They lose interest in sex. They become almost like a dummy. And so, yes, you can slow down the oxidation process, the accumulation of air, but if you do it by simply eating less calories, the price you pay is you lose interest in life itself. What's the point of living longer, if things get boring and life becomes a haze? And that's the price you pay with the only known way to extend the lifespan. However, in all fairness, we should point out that the second best way to reverse some of the ravages of the aging process is, well, there's a fountain of youth, and that fountain of youth is called exercise. Now, I know some of you may not want to hear it, but yes, exercise, besides caloric restriction, is perhaps the second best way that we have of reversing some of the ravages of the aging process. So, a word to the wise. Go out and exercise. Get the blood going. Get your muscles pumping, and perhaps you will have a fountain of youth. Well, once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku saying that you should go to my website, Welcome back to Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. So in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on our second guest, who's going to take us through a long view of the last 10 years, especially with regards to the environment. Our special guest is Lester Brown, founder of the Worldwise Institute, founder of the Earth Policy Institute, one of the world's leading environmentalists. If you were to draw a short list of environmentalists who've done the most in terms of changing world opinion and providing real substantive information about the environment, Lester Brown's name would be near the top of that list. So once again, we're going to be talking about his book, Plan B. Plan A, of course, is doing nothing. Plan B is taking a proactive look at the environment. So once again, our special guest is Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute. Mr. Brown,
Can you tell us a little bit about the Earth Policy Institute, which you helped to found?
Well, the Earth Policy Institute is a small nonprofit research institute in Washington, D.C., that I started, I guess, 8 years ago now. And its purpose is twofold. One is to give a sense of what a sustainable world would look like. And then second, kind of a roadmap on how we get from here to there. Everything that we do, including Plan B, the Plan B series now, is on our website free of charge. We did Plan B, the first one, was it, I guess 6 years ago now, because Plan A, business as usual, is not working very well, and we wanted to give a sense of what an alternative future might look like, and so we started the Plan B series, and then, we did Plan B, and then it became clear that things were happening, and we needed to update it with new technologies and new developments, new challenges, and so forth. And so now we've sort of fallen into the habit of updating it every 2 years, or in the case of Plan B 4.0, which is just coming out now, in less than 2 years, because things are happening so fast. But Plan B is a broad-based plan that includes environmental issues like climate change and population growth. And it has four basic goals: one, stabilize climate; two, stabilize population; three, eradicate poverty. And I would point out that stabilizing population and eradicating poverty are closely related. And then the fourth is to restore the Earth's natural systems, its forests, grasslands, soils, fisheries, aquifers, and so forth.
Well, that's really quite an agenda, but let's break it down one by one. First of all, it was Malthus who predicted hundreds of years ago that any society that exceeds its food supply with an expanding population is going to face starvation. And there have been many dire predictions of a population bomb going back to the 1960s. Well, let's talk about this. First of all, food. We did have the Green Revolution, which helped to tamp down some of the expectations of a population bomb. But are food harvests keeping up?
You know, I was in 1970 when Norman Borlaug got the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in developing the high-yielding dwarf wheats. I was asked to do the appreciation piece, as they're called, for science, and I ended it by saying that Norman Borlaug has made an enormous contribution to doubling and tripling wheat yields in various countries around the world. But if we don't get the brakes on population growth, his work will have been in vain. Let it not be so. That's how the article ended, and that was 1970. And what has happened since then, as you know, is world populations continue to grow. We've slowed the rate of growth from about 2% at that time to just over 1% today, but the number of people we're adding is roughly the same or a bit more. Back then, we were adding maybe 70 million people a year. Now we're adding 80 million people a year, and these people are being added, almost all of them, in the lower-income countries, countries that are already pressing against the limits of their croplands, their soils, and their water resources. So we've made a lot of progress on the food front, but it's been largely washed away by population growth. And what we're now seeing is a deterioration in the food situation. We had gotten the number of hungry people in the world down to about 815 million in the mid-90s. And then last year, it went up to 900 million, and this year it's gone past a billion. And the projections are now for the in the years ahead for food prices to go up and most likely the number of hungry people to increase. So it's not a happy situation in the sense that we've made progress on the food front, but we've not made much progress on the population front. And if we can't get the brakes on population growth, if we can't accelerate the shift to smaller families, if we can't lower fertility, then rising death rates will eventually begin to check population growth. And that's what we're beginning to see in a few countries already.
Okay, well, let's break it down. Food, water, population. First, food. Our food harvest peaking? Some people think that we had the Green Revolution, but the Green Revolution is sputtering in light of the population explosion. But what about food harvests?
Well, the world grain harvest is still increasing. It's now a bit over 2 billion tons per year. The problem is it's not increasing fast enough. And what we're now beginning to see is a new set of trends develop. I mean, from time to time, I go back and look at earlier civilizations that declined and collapsed and read the latest analyses of the latest findings as to why and so forth. And more often than not, with the early civilizations like the Sumerians or the Mayans, it was the food supply that was the weak link in their system. And I've long rejected that idea for our modern civilization. But I've now begun to realize that the environmental trends that are undermining the food prospect are all continuing. And whereas we have seen grain price surges from time to time over the last half century or so, they have been event-driven. A poor harvest in the Soviet Union, a monsoon failure in India, or intense heat wave in the U.S. Corn Belt, for example. But what we're now seeing is a trend-driven tightening of world food supplies. And those trends include soil erosion, falling water tables, rising temperature. And the rising temperature not only directly affects crops, but it also melts the ice sheets, which raise sea level. And this is where the rice-growing river deltas of Asia are particularly vulnerable. And then we're seeing the melting of glaciers in the mountains, and that's important in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau, because it's the ice melt from these glaciers that sustains the river systems, the major rivers of Asia, and the irrigation systems dependent on them during the dry season. And I don't think we've yet quite realized the dimensions of the threat to our future food security that's now associated with ice melting alone.
Okay, you mentioned the fact that grain harvests are not peaking, but they're only growing very slowly. What about seafood? Are we beginning to clear out the oceans of sea life? Are we beginning to peak in terms of seafood production?
Well, the world fish catch has not increased, has not changed very much since 1990. But a majority of the world's fisheries, I think FAO says 70%, are being fished either at or beyond capacity. And the fish that we're catching are getting smaller and smaller as the larger fish, fish like tuna, for example, are fished out, and we're sort of moving down to smaller fish, both in terms of species but also within species. There are not a lot of large, mature adults reproducing in many of these fisheries, which is why they're declining and collapsing. And we have just reached the point where fish farming is now very close to producing as much as we catch in the oceans, but the problem is that with fish farming, once you put fish in ponds, you have to feed them, and what you feed them typically for carp in China, which is where most of the fish farming is, you feed them grain and soybean meal, and that puts more pressure on land resources. So we've kind of reached the limits in oceans, and now the pressure for more fish and seafood generally is shifting to fish farming and additional pressure on land and water resources.
Now, you mentioned population several times. What is the current world population, and how is it going to grow by, let's say, mid-century and by the end of the century? What does the United Nations and other demographers predict the population will look like in the coming decades?
Well, world population now is about 6.7 billion, and it's projected to grow by mid-century using the medium UN projections to 9.2 billion, so about another 2.5 billion by mid-century. But my own sense is that those projections are not going to materialize because we're already seeing systems beginning to break down under the pressure of existing population. Let me just cite some quick examples with water to illustrate that point. Saudi Arabia, after the oil export embargo back in the 1970s, realized it would be vulnerable to a grain export embargo. So the Saudis began looking around for water, and using their oil drilling technology, they found a fossil aquifer about a half mile down, and they have been pumping that to be self-sufficient in wheat. They've been self-sufficient in wheat for more than 20 years now. But last year, they announced that that aquifer was largely gone, and that in each of the next 8 years, they're going to reduce their wheat harvest by 1/8, and by 2016, they would be out of the grain production business. And their Canada-sized population, about 30 million, would be entirely dependent on grain imports. Now, Yemen, which is next door, has a somewhat different problem in that they have an aquifer that is rechargeable, about 22 million people living in Yemen. But they're pumping at about 4 times the rate of recharge. So water tables are falling throughout the country. And even the capital now, many of the wells are going dry, and they don't have enough water for people in the capital city of Yemen. So Yemen has become sort of a hydrological basket case because it has fast-disappearing water supplies. It has one of the most rapid population growth rates of any country in the world, and it's one of the poorest of the Arab countries. So we're looking at actually the beginning of a failing state in Yemen, and things are going to get much worse in the years ahead. Now, both Saudi Arabia and Yemen are relatively small, but when you look at a country like India, the World Bank did a study there a few years ago pointing out that 15% of the people in India are fed with grain produced by overpumping. Stated otherwise, 175 million Indians are being fed with irrigation water from wells that will be going dry. The comparable number for China is about 130 million. So between the two countries, there are 300 million people or so who are being fed with the unsustainable use of water. And this is going to become a reality in the not-too-distant future, this loss of irrigation water needed to produce grain. So this is the troubling thing about the water situation, is that it's deteriorating in many countries at the same time and at an accelerating rate. So when we look at water shortages in key countries, we're really looking at food shortages.
Now, some people say there's perhaps a glimmer of hope in the sense that as nations begin to urbanize, the birth rate goes down. It's harder to have children in an urban situation. And as they become middle class, they also tend to have less children. But that tendency is balanced against the fact that the population is booming in poor countries. So overall, do you think that the population is going to continue at a galloping rate, even with those demographic changes?
The question in my mind is not whether we're going to see massive future increases in population, because I don't think we will. The question is, will we not see them because we get our act together and accelerate the shift to smaller families, or because we fail to, and rising mortality begins to take over, as it's beginning to in a few countries. So this is the choice we're going to have to make. And I think the social costs of having neglected the population issue so much over the last few decades is, I think the social costs are going to be very high.
Now, some people say that it's one thing to cure diseases and to help the poor, but another thing to witness the expansion of the population where there are no jobs for these people, and all these young people without jobs creates resentment. So what are your thoughts? Are we going to be able to have jobs for all the exploding population, or are we going to have to find some way to rein in the populations even as medical care gets better?
Well, there's no question but that population growth is going to slow substantially in the years ahead. And again, will it slow because we get our act together and accelerate the shift to smaller families, or because we fail to do so and mortality rates begin to rise in more and more countries? I mean, I was just thinking in recent days about the sort of dilemma that many of the Muslim countries face. The key, as you know, to moving to smaller families is to increase female education. But in societies that are opposed to educating females, that doesn't work. And so they're sort of locked into continuing high fertility. And this is precisely the kind of problem that exists in Yemen, for example, or in Afghanistan. How we deal with that is going to be a key factor in the how things turn out on the population front.
Now, let's talk about global warming. You referred to it a few times. We have the recession of the glaciers. We're concerned about the stability of the North and the South Pole. What's happening with regards to global climate change?
Well, it seems like almost every time you read a new report on climate change, things are moving faster than we had thought they would. And this is clearly the case with ice melting. We're looking at the melting of the Greenland ice sheet now. It is melting. That's not a debatable point. And the melting is accelerating. And we know that if the entire thing were to entire ice sheet were to melt, that sea level would rise 23 feet. But we also know now that in the latest reports that during this century, the scientists who a few years ago were saying that sea level could rise up to a foot and a half in this century are now saying it could be up to 6 feet.
Even up to a 1 meter, 6 feet in this century, huh?
Yes. Even a 1 meter rise in sea level, 3 feet roughly, would cover half the rice land in Bangladesh. And it would wreak havoc in the Mekong Delta, where half of Vietnam's rice harvest is produced. Vietnam is the world's second-ranking rice exporter. And there are another 20 rice-growing river deltas in Asia that would be directly affected by even a modest rise in sea level a few feet. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is the melting of the glaciers, the world's mountain glaciers, and the Global Glacier Monitoring Service in Switzerland has now reported 18 consecutive years of shrinking mountain glaciers around the world. And that is a matter of concern, particularly in Asia, where it's the glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau that sustain the major rivers like the Indus and the Ganges, the Yangtze and the Yellow River during the dry season. And anything that disrupts the flow of those rivers and their irrigation systems will shrink the wheat and the rice harvests of countries like China and India. And we forget, or maybe some of us didn't even know, that China's the world's leading wheat producer. India's number two. The U.S. is number three. I think a lot of Americans think the U.S. is probably the leader. We dominate exports, but we're not the largest producer by any means. And China and India totally dominate the world rice harvest. So what happens to their harvests will affect us directly. And I point out in Plan B 4.0 that if the Chinese come into the world market for massive quantities of grain, as they already have done for soybeans, they're now importing 70% of their total soybean consumption. If they come into the world market for large quantities of Ukraine, as I'm convinced they will, they will come to the United States because we totally dominate world grain exports. So what we're looking at is a fascinating sort of geopolitical situation where 1.3 billion Chinese with rapidly rising incomes begin to compete with us for our grain harvest, driving up our food prices. Now, historically, in a situation like that, we would have restricted grain exports. But China is our banker now. Every month when the U.S. Treasury Department auctions off securities to cover our fiscal deficit, one of the big buyers, and some months the biggest buyer, are the Chinese. And so, like it or not, we're going to be sharing our grain harvest with the Chinese on a scale that we probably can't even imagine at the moment.
Okay. Now, you mentioned 6 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century, perhaps. Of course, these are all projections. What's going to happen if that happens? I mean, are cities going to be underwater? Are we going to have dikes? Are mass migrations from the coastal areas? What impact will that have?
Well, if sea level rises 6 feet, many of the world's coastal cities will be partly or almost totally inundated. Cities like London, Shanghai, Cairo, Miami, New Orleans, obviously. And what we're looking at is scores of cities, many of them very populous cities, being affected by rising sea level and millions of rising sea refugees. Now, what that will do in a country like the United States, for example, is it will create two real estate markets. One will be in the low-lying coastal regions where real estate prices will plummet, and a second real estate market more in the interior of the country where real estate prices will soar as people try to move from coastal regions to the interior. And it's a situation unlike any we've ever faced before. But this is what global warming is all about. And I think we're having a hard time grasping the reality of what's happening and what will happen if we continue with business as usual or anything close to business as usual.
Now let's say a few things about energy. Some people say that one way to attack global warming is to change our dependence on fossil fuels. But of course, fossil fuels energizes the entire economy. So could you give us a little snapshot of what's happening with wind power, solar power, and other forms of power, perhaps the fuel cell battery, in terms of dealing with this energy situation?
Well, one of the reasons that we telescope the time or shorten the time between Plan B 3.0 and Plan B 4.0 is because things are happening so fast. When we were working on Plan B 3.0 2 years ago, we could not imagine the rate and the scale at which renewable energy sources are now being developed. And so we devote a chapter in Plan B 4.0 entirely to this phenomenon. We look at wind power, for example. Just consider the U.S. state of Texas. Texas has about 8,000 megawatts of wind energy now in operation. They have another 1 or 2 megawatts under construction, but a whole bunch more in the development stage. Altogether, it totals over 50,000 megawatts of wind-generating capacity. I mean, think 50 coal-fired power plants. This is huge. We've never seen anything quite like it before. But, well, we're moving pretty fast with wind now. I mean, last year, for example, we added 8,400 megawatts of wind-generating capacity. New coal capacity last year was 1,400 megawatts. So wind is just totally taking over in terms of growth now. And in fact, some coal plants are now closing. So things are beginning to change very fast. And as you know, we have enough harnessable wind energy in 3 states, North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas, to power the entire U.S. economy. So it's not a matter of lacking resources. We have the resources. But the country that's really building ahead of steam on the wind front now is China. They have been doubling their wind generating capacity each year now for 4 years. They're latecomers to wind energy, but they are moving at an incredible pace. And sometime before the end of this year, within the next few months, the Chinese are going to pass us in terms of new generating capacity being added, and they're going to go by us so fast that we may not even see them. I mean, they are now, the government has organized 6 mega wind farm complexes with generating capacities in each that will range from 10,000 megawatts to 30,000 megawatts. I mean, these are huge. In total, they will add more than 100,000 megawatts to China's generating capacity. The Chinese, in fact, there was a joint U.S.-Chinese study and analysis of their wind resources just published in Science a few weeks ago. This study pointed out that China's wind generating potential is 7 times their current electricity consumption. So like us, they have an enormous amount of wind energy that they can harness, and they're beginning to do it on a scale we've never seen before.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Lester Brown, world-famous environmentalist. And also go to my website. You can find out where I'll be speaking. And you can also see reference to the 4 New York Times bestsellers that I've written, the last one being The Future of Humanity. So once again, it's mkaku.org. Go to that website to find out what I'm up to. And maybe one day I'll sign your copy of one of my bestsellers. And then, of course, after that, you can go to eBay and auction it off for money. That's right. You can actually make money on a book tour. So this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration.